Accession number 27272, Mr. Malcolm Frost, Drill 6. Now, we're talking about conditions when you were assigned as a signaller to the mortar platoon in the support company with the 1st Royal Fusiliers. Now, what did you have a rum ration with? We talked about some of the other rations. What about rum ration?
In the winter, we were given a rum ration. It was equivalent, I believe, to what the Navy had. It was a dark rum, I remember, and quite strong. And we had a small grog a day. We were supposed to drink it when we got it. Some of us used to store it for after use. And
how was it issued?
It was issued by one of the NCOs, senior NCOs. And it came up by colour sergeant, brought it up, if I remember rightly. And it was issued on a daily basis in the evening before we stood to for any evening duties when it was really cold.
And how did you manage to store it? Did you not want to drink it? They were supposed to.
We had aluminium water bottles, the standard army issue, and I wasn't that keen on rum, but I did drink it occasionally, and I used to put mine into my water bottle. If we had an inspection, which obviously did occur occasionally, I always had a fear that when they shook my water bottle and opened it, instead of finding water, they might find something a bit more potent. So I kept, during the winter, a small stock of rum in my water bottle, which wasn't acceptable, but nobody ever found out anyway.
Now, what about the latrine arrangements? I didn't ask about that before. What sort of latrine did you have?
We had urinals, we had what we called desert roses.
Now, can you explain what that is?
Well, all it was a tube from a mortar ammunition, which was a large metal tube. This was merely sunk into the ground in a spot where there's reasonable drainage, and that was used as an open urinal. There's no cover around it, just literally exposed to the elements. Latrines were a large pit was dug, it was limed usually, and then a wooden seat was placed across the top. I remember when we were in reserve, there was many six seats in one latrine. But usually it was just a couple, and it was merely was a pit with a wooden seat on top, and it was limed regularly or burnt out regularly. It was pretty unhygienic, but it was somewhere to go.
Now, what about a typical day? This is in the first week, so this is August, that would be, August still.
Yeah.
It'd be summer when you first moved in. What was a typical day like for you when you were first attached to the mortar platoon?
Well, a typical day, the mortar platoon would stand to, make sure the weapons were primed and ready, ammunition was there. And we were stood by with normal communications with the forward observation posts. Bearing in mind that they were sitting up more to the front than we were. We had a mortar corporal or a mortar sergeant would be up in the OP, and he would give firing directions in terms of distance to the mortar platoon. So we would be standing by with that communication and had that under control. We'd also be in communication with central headquarters. So as a signaller, really the duty was communication with forward observation post and communication with the rest of the network, which covered the whole battalion. So I would be doing regular wireless checks, checking signal strengths and the fact that we had clear communication with every company, with headquarter company and with the forward observation posts. That would be done on a sort of semi-shift basis because there was a signal NCO and two signalers attached to the one platoon. And we took it in turns to do so many hours on, and the same at night. We split the night shift into reasonable sized watches. Preparing food was part of the day. Cleaning up, making sure the area was kept clean and tidy. There was one problem because we was always infested with rats.
Was that a real problem?
That was a problem with rats. If you left any food about, then basically you were going to be infested with them fairly quickly. I remember on one occasion I woke up in my bunker because we were provided with mosquito nets, and I woke up and found a rat sitting on my chest, which was quite frightening, really. We had a captain who was the platoon commander, and he was, I think he was Belgian, came from Belgian Congo. He certainly was not of English descent, Captain Walter Kine, and he was petrified of rats. And he had a batman, a little lad called Tony Fasani, I remember well, of Italian descent. And I remember on one occasion hearing a gunfire coming from Captain Walkine's bunker, and he was apparently trying to bump off rats which were in his bunker with his using his Army 38 revolver. He then, I know on one occasion, he got one of the Pioneer Corps support sergeants to come up with some plastic explosive, and he actually was putting small quantities of plastic explosive into rat holes and blowing them up because he was petrified of the rats we had. But they were quite a problem.
Any other problems? You know, animal
mosquitoes, or obviously.
Tell me about that.
Well, we were given anti-malarial tablets every day, and we had to make sure we took Paludrin every day of every day of the time we were abroad. Mosquitoes weren't really a problem, except sort of during the or after the monsoon period when everywhere was sort of running with water. But we did have mosquito nets when we were able to sleep on a bunk, which meant we were protected reasonably from mosquitoes.
Any other problems? Insects or snakes or anything, you know?
Snakes? No, I don't remember snakes being a problem in Korea, certainly not. It was a sort of a barren, non sort of populated country as far as animals are concerned.
Now, what about, where were the Chinese or the, you know, in or the Korean, North Koreans, in relation to where you were? I mean, you were just behind
We'd be about something like a mile, three quarters of a mile perhaps, from behind the front positions, with the mortar platoon obviously supporting them when they went out on patrols. So we didn't actually, I didn't see a lot of the actual Chinese front line, other than if I went up to one of the forward posts, which wasn't very often because...
Why would you do that when you did?
Only to really more of a curiosity. I did go up on a couple of occasions when the Americans were doing some airstrikes on the Chinese bunkers, and I was horrified, I must admit, when I saw the napalm. Napalm bombs to me were totally sort of horrendous. And I know they were used in Vietnam because I remember having seen television pictures before I went abroad, but to actually see them drop them and to see a complete sort of hillside explode into one enormous mass of flame and realise that there were obviously people underneath that, it seemed quite barbaric to me. It was quite peculiar because the napalm bombs were like the petrol tanks you might see on the wing of an aircraft. When they dropped it, it sort of spiraled down, it sort of quite seemed to be in slow motion before it actually hit the deck. And then when it exploded, obviously it was an enormous burst of flame. And everywhere the whole thing spread in enormous distance. That didn't appeal at all.
Now, when you first went, it was summer. What was the weather like?
It was hot. It was very dry, very dusty. When it was summer and we were in reserve, we actually used to get a chance to go swimming.
Now, tell me about it. So you'd pull back. How long were you in the front line before you came
back? 6 weeks roughly in the line. You'd do 6 weeks roughly in reserve.
Now, what were periods in reserve like?
They were in a tented accommodation, normally.
You know where it was?
Yeah, we were in, I remember one in particular, was Camp Casey.
Camp Casey.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was a large tented area where the whole battalion actually were housed. We were housed sort of by companies, basically. So the signal platoon would all be together. Bearing in mind that during the normal front line period, signalers would be split between A, B, C and D companies, the various support companies. So as a platoon, we only actually come together as a platoon when we're in reserve. So that's when we met basically the other signallers, who we didn't have much contact with whilst we were in the front line. We had camp beds, which we didn't have obviously when we were in the line. Beds were improvised beds made by iron rods and cable. We had a cookhouse, obviously, and we were given normal army-type cooked meals. We got a lot of turkey for some reason, but it was boiled rather than roasted. But the meals were quite reasonable.
What would you do?
Well, we did some additional training during reserve. A lot of it was basically keeping fit, keeping discipline. We did several night exercises when we were in reserve, like going laying lines at night.
Now tell me about the night exercise. How did it go?
Well, as a signaller, we really basically were merely making sure that we could lay lines in the dark. We could make sure they were tied back so they didn't get damaged by passing vehicles. And at the end of the time, you had a field telephone or a telejig, which you then had to communicate back with somebody at the other end to make sure you'd actually successfully laid a line, and that you could actually do it in the dark as a two-man team or three-man team, and many of us decided was needed to do it. That was mainly it. Obviously keeping abreast of wireless techniques, but once you'd learnt the wireless codes, you didn't really, there wasn't much you could do with wireless training, to be honest.
Anything else about periods in reserve? Oh, you said swimming. Tell us about that.
Well, we went to the Imjin for swimming on
which river?
The River Imjin. On a number of occasions. The only trouble was, it was quite funny in the summer. You go in the back of a 3-ton truck and go for a swim in skinny dipping in the nude, obviously. And but when you went back to reserve site, you'd be sort of totally filthy anyway, because the only tarmac Adam roads I ever saw in Korea were actually in the capital Seoul. All the rest of the roads were just dirt tracks. But it was nice to get into the water for a swim.
What was it like swimming in now? It's a big river.
It was a big river, but it was the banks where we used to go were almost beach-like. It was very fast current in it, but not sort of by the bank. But it was, I don't know how you'd equate it to the Thames. It was a lot wider than the Thames.
Was it? I mean, were people warned to be careful?
Oh, you had to be careful. Yeah, we didn't swim far. Just swam around the perimeter of the edges of the water. While we were in reserve, there was a quota system worked for R&R leave, rest recuperation, and there was actually a R&R base set up at Incheon, which is where the original Marines landing had taken place during the early part of the Korean War.
Where was that?
Incheon, I-N-C-H-O-N, Incheon.
What was that like?
It was a tented R&R camp. I was fortunate enough to go once. It was staffed by South Koreans with young South Korean waitresses. The food was mainly Korean type food with rice, but it was a 5-day break, and we actually had a reasonable bed and actual sheets, which made a change. It was just a break to get away from the chores of the normal sort of military style life, and it was a total relaxation. We're not asked to do anything. It literally was just total relaxation. We also had the opportunity to get to Japan on R&R, which was a 5-day break.
Now, did you go on that?
Yep, I came up for that. It was mid part of 1953, and we went by American Skymaster, which is one of these enormous American troop aircraft. But I'd never flown before. And I was quite, shall I say, not petrified, but I was quite worried about it. But we took off, and within 4 or 5 minutes, we were coming down again. And I had horrors of the thing was actually going to crash. What actually happened, it was quite odd. We'd taken off, and we landed at Seoul. And the reason it landed at Seoul was there had been, or they insisted, that there was a stowaway on board. We were all taken off the aircraft, counted off the aircraft. We stood beside the aircraft and stood and waited while an American strike force of Tornadoes took off to do a strike, and then we were counted back on again, and there was no stowaway with exactly the right numbers. Somebody got it all wrong. But then we finished up in Tokyo for 5 days R&R.
What was that like?
That was brilliant. One or two of the squaddies I saw when they got off the aircraft, I didn't see them again till they got on. But a lot of us, I mean, we were interested. I was interested in the culture, Japanese culture. And we were looked after by the WRVS. And I had the opportunity to do things I couldn't have anticipated I would ever be able to do.
Now, what kind of things?
Well, they took us on trips. First, one of the first trips we went on was to the original Bonsai Gardens, which absolutely fantastic. I couldn't believe the trees, 200 years old, standing about a foot high. I'd never seen bonsai culture, obviously. So that was quite an experience. They took us to the Eagle Silk Mill, where I saw the silk from the worm to the finished product. They took us to a science and medical museum, which again was totally interesting. They also took us to Tokyo radio and television headquarters. I sat in on the American news broadcast while the Americans were doing a news broadcast from there. And I saw a Japanese children's television program being produced. But to me, because 1952, television was, to me, a novelty. So they looked after us extremely well.
So there was the chance to do more than just go out and get drunk, then? You know,
very much plenty, so. Plenty of them did go and get drunk, but not me, no. Went to the Ginza Market as well. It was a five-day cultural and interesting experience if you wanted it. You could go and find young ladies of ill repute if you wanted to and spend your money, but some of us just felt it was an opportunity not to be missed.
And how did you get on with the Japanese? I mean, it wasn't that bad after the war, was it?
I mean, there was no... I didn't feel there was any great resentment. I mean, I think some of the old sweats who had been involved in the Second World War, and particularly one or two that had fought Far East, they might have felt a bit resentful. But no, they were quite pleasant to us. I mean, we were spending money, and that was...
And there was no... I mean...
There was no animosity.
No animosity from them.
No.
Now that was a bit later, but we were sort of dealing with rest camp things. So that was in 53 there.
Yeah.
Were you going backwards and forwards between reserve and the same place? You know, in the front line.
No, we're going to different places in the line. For me, I can never remember whether I know we were on Hill 355 on one occasion. We took over from the Americans, and of course we finished up on the hook after the Duke of Wellington's got hit. But you were 6 weeks, roughly, in the line, 6 weeks in reserve, so you could say 3 months, really, and we were there just about the year, so we took up about three or four different positions in the line.
Do you remember Hill 355?
Yeah, but not in great detail, I must admit. I know there's a song, I don't know if I've mentioned it before, but there's a song that... the Chinese are coming up 355, the Yanks running down the other side, amongst other verses which are not repeatable. So 355, that was probably one of the less favourable spots to be.
Why not?
Well, there's one or two quite exposed communication routes on it which had to be quite well camouflaged, and they were prone to be shelled and mortared quite a lot. We didn't get an awful lot of incoming artillery all the time. It came to us in sort of bursts.
What was it like? Because the first time under fire, I mean, you were always in these sort of positions.
The companies which were up seeing in the front line trenches. I mean, they had fortified trenches and bunkers as well, but they obviously got mortars and shells. Their main sort of activity was patrols, where they were exposed to enemy action and enemy fire. We were merely, because we were in a back position, we were exposed to incoming mortars and incoming artillery.
Now, what was it like being under that for the first time?
First time, quite frightening. The first mortar bombs exploded close. I must admit, I was shaking in my boots. but you soon got used to it. When the first one came in, you took cover where you, if you had to, or you remained a bit exposed if you had to be out in the open. It was something you got used to quite quickly, to be honest.
Did you get to know when a shell was going to land close to you? I mean, because some say that...
When the first ones used to come in, you'd take cover if you could, obviously, and I was sort of unfortunate enough to get wounded in November.
Ah, we'll come to that.
Yeah, but that was always a bit of a mystery, actually.
I will. Now, and what about shell? Could you tell the difference between mortar fire and shell fire? Was it
fire? Yeah, well, mainly mortar fire, mortar type fire. Shell fire was heavier. I'll tell you later, we did come under one enormous artillery attack, which was planned, or which had been forecast by a prisoner of war that they'd brought in.
That was later.
Okay. in the day.
What about you? Did you get less nervous or more nervous? How were you feeling in yourself?
I think it became sort of a routine that basically you didn't sort of bother. I know if you talk to some of my ex-army comrades who were in the forward companies, the first patrols they did, they, like me, were pretty scared. But after a while, it became a routine, although they realised, of course, that they could be dangerous when they might not come back.
Now, what about communications with home? I mean, what did lesser letters, anything?
My mother, most of the stuff used to come sea mail, and it took somewhere around about 5 weeks to get to us. But we got mail quite regularly. My mother used to send me the local newspaper fairly regularly, so I knew what was going on back home in Norfolk. Got letters from home from various girls that I kept in touch with.
And what would they write about? I mean,
they'd write about what's happening back home. I'd write and tell them what was happening where I was.
Were you censored? Or were you aware that you were?
We were provided with the standard airmail letter types, which we were allowed to write. There was no real censoring, as far as I was concerned.
Were the letters important to you, getting
married? Very important. Contact with home was extremely important. Obviously, I wanted to know how my family were all the while. I know my parents were both in good health. The rest of the family were. Well, it was only my sister and my brother had died before I went into the forces. But I mean, I just wanted to know that they were okay and what was happening back home. So, yeah, we had regular contact.
So you'd write, how often would you write to your parents?
Once every week, 10 days. Just let them know it's okay.
And did they send you parcels, or were they allowed
to? Yeah, they sent parcels.
What did they send?
Sweets, mainly sweets. Sent me socks occasionally, which really didn't. We had plenty of sort of army style socks. Not many things, mainly sort of small food parcels that they sent, chocolate, things like that.
And so anything else? I mean, anything else about Hill War 355 when you were on there?
No, not really. Birdcage Walk, which was the camouflaged area, which was exposed, but no, there wasn't great deal more of that.
What about the monsoon? What month was that? Was that shortly after you got there?
I'm trying to think. You had sort of a spring, then you had hot period, then you had the monsoon, then you had winter. So you had dust, then you had mud, then you had ice and cold. Rains were extremely heavy, but again, we were well sort of waterproofed. Bungers used to leak a bit in the rain, but the monsoon period wasn't that bad, quite honestly.
How heavy was the rain? I mean,
it's torrential rain. What we would regard here as an actual downpour was sort of almost continuous during the monsoon period, but it didn't last very long. Can't remember really how long it was, but it wasn't very long.
And then the cold had started.
Yeah.
Now, what was the cold weather like?
Indescribable. I've never experienced anything like it before, and never experienced anything like it again. It was bitter. There wasn't much snow. It was just a hard frost, temperature down to about -15°C. Or a bit more than that on occasions. There was a bitterly cold wind sort of blowing down from Siberia. We were well equipped, obviously, with our winter clothing, but it was still absolutely freezing. And you had to be careful what you touched, particularly metal, because it was so cold it would actually, your hand would actually adhere to the cold metal, the frozen metal. I mean, people don't believe it, but I've actually picked up a razor to shave in hot tea, and the razor was actually stuck and burnt your hand because it's been that cold. You couldn't afford to take your boots off. If you took your boots off, the perspiration in your boots would freeze solid, and then your two boots would be like two blocks of concrete. You couldn't get them back on again. So for long periods during the winter, apart from taking them off to wash your feet, you put them back on again, because otherwise they just went solid. That sounds ridiculous, but that's true.